All right. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to call the meeting to order and first begin with a Pledge of Allegiance. And Ann, can you call the roll?
Director Costello?
Here.
Director Carbone?
Here.
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 Great, thank you. Now we're going to move on to public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to us about items that are not on today's agenda but are within the purview of this body. Is there anyone who would like to speak to us on public comment? Do we want to ask her? She's just been waiting. Okay. Seeing none, we'll move on to reports by the committee chairs on committee meetings. The first is the Budget Personnel Nominating Committee. We met earlier today. The primary things we focused on was to recommend disencumbering prior year's AB 2766 grants, reports on our investments for both our budget and the OPEB budget, and a small adjustment to the 2019-2020 budget that'll be in today's packet. Did the advisory committee meet? Moving on to item number six, this is comments and referrals from the chair or the board members. Is anyone, anything people would like to share? Okay, seeing none, we're going to move on to seven, which is a report from our air pollution control officer.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Rich. Appreciate that. For the schools program, you want us to wait to do outreach to the schools on your behalf until the program's been set up?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. So now we'll move on to the consent agenda. These are items 8 through 11 on our agenda. First, I'll ask if there are any questions. Seeing no questions, I'll ask if there's public comment. Seeing no public comment, I'll bring it back to the board. All right, motion by Parker, second by Carbone. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. Now we'll move on to item number 12, which is to receive the fiscal year AB 2766 applicant summary and staff recommendations.
Good afternoon, directors, Chairman Coonerty. We do this every year. We present a summary of the applicants that have submitted the applications for fiscal year 20. We also include an executive summary, which tells you where the projects are with respect to our ranking model that we use, the methodology we've been using since 2012. What we've done to really streamline this program is we separated the program into two components. One's called clean air management. These are direct emission reduction projects that are typically fixed assets. Some of the things that are included are roundabout design and construction, adaptive traffic control, fleet replacement with electric vehicles, that's pretty much it. The other component of our 2766 program is called the clean vehicle program. Divvied up into public agency vouchers for electric vehicles. And as Richard mentioned, our Monterey Bay electric vehicle incentive program for residents of the three counties. Typically what we do, it's not just a throw a dart. We allocate funding based on population density of each of the counties. And so based upon 2018, we do this every year. We go back to the census, we look at the population estimates, and we divvy up according to population. So if you look at fiscal year 20, we're looking at the numbers for each of the counties, a little over a million for Monterey, 720 something and change for Santa Cruz, and a big whopping 161 for San Benito County. Probably one of the largest allocations we've had in recent years. A lot of that due to a large disencumbrance of funds from previous funding. So our total funding level for the two programs, which it includes our incentive program to the public, which is a $400,000 chunk of change, and a little over $2 million for the rest of the projects, we're looking at $2.4 million. So what we had this year, we had 10 direct emission project applications. They're all great projects. You can see the breakdown by county. We had 5 from Monterey, 2 from San Benito, and 3 from Santa Cruz County. For a grand total of a little over $3 million in requested funding. This is summarized in your board report in front of you. We do this every year to alert some of the newer board members. How do we come up with these magic numbers? Well, we don't. We actually do calculations. These calculations are dictated to all of the agencies using DMB funds to do this. It comes from CMAQ methodology from ARB. Every time the emission factors from the state ARB come down, they redo their tables. And so CMAQ methodology, the last update was 2013. This year it's 2018. And they're basically grounded on the emission factor tables from MFAC. this year. MFAC is at 2014. The EPA just approved the MFAC 2017. The point here is that these emission factors change year to year. So as the fleets get cleaner, the emission factors get tighter. So that means the emission reduction that we calculate is not quite as big as it may have been in previous years. This makes it tough for certain projects that come to us on the application table. In particular, when somebody wants to replace one vehicle with an old vehicle with low mileage, it typically doesn't score well. And we'll get into that. We can get into that either next month or sometime this afternoon. So when we do this ranking based on the calculation, we look at it in terms of cost-effectiveness dollar value. And cost-effectiveness, again, it's represented as a cost per pound or ton of pollutant reduced on an annual basis. That cost-effectiveness number also has an amortization factor called capital recovery. And what it does is it just basically amortizes that cost over the projected life of that particular project. But each of these projects have different project lives. And then after that, we look at what the annual emission reduction would calculate out to be. And so with those two criteria, we rank these projects accordingly. So you can see that a low CE is good. A high CE is not good. You can think of it in terms of opportunity cost. And that really is what these dollars represent. So with that, we want to just talk a little bit about, as Richard mentioned, our Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program. We were directed by both boards, this board and the board from Monterey Community Power, to join forces and come up with a joint EV incentive program. So we called it Monterey Bay EVIP. And we had two phases. Phase one, obviously hosted by Community Power. It was a very interesting way to do this. The word that I like to use is very prescriptive, because it only authorized three different types of electric vehicles from three specific dealers within the Monterey Bay region. And so the dollar amount is the same as ours. It's $1,000 for a full electric, $750 for a battery or a plug-in hybrid. And then they also incentivize public agencies, nonprofits, and also low-income families. Phase two are your choice, your terms. You can buy anywhere in the state of California, and you can buy any electric vehicle that's out there that's on the state eligibility list. One thing that's as Rich pointed out, is that it offers the EV driver the opportunity to really look at what is it that's going to suit their needs. Do they need a 300 mile range car, or will a 100 mile range car suffice for a small daily commute of less than 30 miles a day? So it's really important, if we're going to try to expand the EV experience in our particular neck of the woods, it really behooves any agency putting incentive monies in front of the table to try to offer as much choice as possible. So phase two kicked off. We're off and running. What's kind of cool about it is this is the first year that we've actually put together an online application, so there's no paperwork involved. We think it's easier for the applicant and definitely easier for staff. So our little bailiwick right here is we'll do fuel cells, we'll do full electric, we'll do battery electric. We're one of the few agencies in the entire state of California that offers incentives for used electric vehicles, whether it's a plug-in hybrid or all battery. One of the things that I wanted to point out, if I can, Ann, can you click on that link there on your table? Okay, sorry. That was our logo for the joint program, EVIP, between the two, Monterey Bay Community Power and us. And I wanted to kind of run you through how easy this appears to be when you do it online. So, Ann, if you could stay there just quickly. So on that tab that says eligibility, it hosts all of our requirements. Once the person's read that, they click over to the eligibility checklist, which is really cool, up at the top, Ann. And so they have to answer all these questions. And if they answer correctly, go down to the bottom, Ann, for just a minute. They answer correctly, then they get to proceed by applying. And if they answer the wrong answer, down where that red text is, it'll tell them, well, wait a minute, you're not eligible because of this. You're either a public agency or a nonprofit or a business, or you don't live in a county, or you bought the vehicle before August 1st. All of those checklist questions will allow you to get to the application. So if everything answers correctly, then you get to hit apply, and you go forward from there. All the required documentation is uploaded and then sent to us you this great little program called Laserfish, which is, I think, is going to be a great segue into helping the agency reduce our paperwork load and administrative load. It's a great program. We're very happy with the way it's working so far. We see a lot of opportunity for it to move into engineering and into compliance in terms of wood smoke management, burn permits, even permits to operate in ATC. So we're very, very optimistic about Laserfish and what its capabilities are. That said, I think it's important to understand that the state is putting a lot of emphasis on electrifying the transportation space. And so what does that mean? As Rich has pointed out, we have our ZESB, which is Zero Emission School Bus Program. We have actually executed 7 grant agreements worth over $1.5 million to 7 different school districts for the purchase of an electric school bus. That's one round, and we'll continue to do that. These same school districts were awarded between, there was a $70 million pot of money from the CEC. Some of our school districts were able to take advantage of that, which is fantastic. In particular, Pajaro Valley School District got 8 buses from the CEC, which is really amazing, in a lump sum, so that's fantastic. Beside that, we were looking at a couple of grant projects in AB 2766 that represent the electrification of the space. The city of Salinas put in a great project for a 3-truck electrification project. MST has put in an application for another e-bus from BYD, so we're very, very strong on that. And to give you an idea of how much walking of the talk the Air District is doing, these are 5 electric vehicles that are at the district offices every day. 3 of them are personally owned by staff, 2 are owned by the agency. I just want to introduce these vehicles. On the far left is our all-electric Kia Soul, which is personally owned by one of our engineers, Armando Jimenez. Next to him is Scott Norton from Air Monitoring. He's in front of the district Chevy Bolt. And in front of him is his own personal e-bike. And the fine young gentleman with his arm wrapped around my Model 3 is Song Kim from engineering. And next to Song is our agents, our fleet, Nissan Leaf. And standing by is our planner, Hannah Muge, who also moonlights as a professional cyclist. And on the right, on the far right, of course, is all-electric Honda Clarity, owned by our planning and air monitoring manager, David Frisbee. So yeah, we're walking the talk and want to continue to do that. With that, I'm happy to entertain any questions.
Are there any questions? Yes, Brooke.
Thank you. Does it make sense to ask questions about the recommendations today, or should we wait until next week?
Well, what we'd like to do is we'd like to give the board a good solid month to digest what we've put together. Fire away.
Yeah, so I had a question in the commission's elimination.
The ranking?
It looked as though the city of Gonzales' roundabout was ahead of the electric vehicle replacement from the city of Salinas, but I see in the recommendation that the city of Salinas' vehicle is being recommended. Does that have to do with the amortization schedule of the benefit, or how did that come about?
Well, it's actually the city of King, their roundabout project.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, we already allocated $176,000 to them, and that's been a very convoluted process because they really thought that they would have to go through the Caltrans process called PDR-PDS, which is a huge, huge loop. And so that money was going to be spent just getting through that loop, which we thought, well, it's not the best way to spend public funds. But in lieu of what was on the table, they were lucky that there was leftover money for them to give them that. So after all that iteration, that has changed now. So Caltrans relented and said, you don't have to do this. Now you can go ahead and design and build your roundabout. Well, the city of King wasn't prepared to hear that because they're 5 years away from that project. And so given that, in contrast to the city of Salinas medium-duty fleet project, those emissions are immediate. As soon as the vehicles show up, and that project life is 15 years, so for 15 years there's zero emission coming out of that project. That's not the case with the roundabout. So yeah, roundabouts are great because based upon the average daily traffic, the VMT reduction is pretty significant, as long as the ADT number is there. But that intersection at the off-ramp is not very heavily traveled. So that's why it doesn't score really well for a roundabout project. Right, they're 5 years away from it.
Materials, I just looked at the recommendations.
Right. So that will be explained in the executive summary.
Process question, in terms of the criteria that we use, do we set that as a board, or is that criteria dictated by ADT 7?
That's what dictates it. Is that what you're asking? So when we have to use all of the models that are in that CMAQ methodology, and there are like 12 different models that you can use, that depending upon what you're doing, you can do. There are carpool models, there are bicycle pedestrian models, there are van pool replacement and vehicle replacement models, there's transit models, traffic signal control, which would include a roundabout. So that's, those are the models that we use.
So is there an equity component, or is that not part of it?
Actually, Rich, ARB dictates, because these are motor vehicle registration fees that we're using, that has to be used. They're pretty sound on that.
Okay, any other questions? Okay. That was just it's no action required. We'll move on to item number 13, which is to receive a presentation and accept and file a report on a daily 8-hour peak ozone concentrations, hourly peak ozone concentrations, PM 2.5 and PM 10 air monitoring data for the first 2 quarters for the year 2019.
Biennial. Good afternoon, Chairman Coonerty and members of the board. I'm Dave Frisby, Planning and Air Monitoring Manager with the district. And I'm just going to provide, as Rich said, the mid-year summary for 2019. Actually run through July of this year. So Air District Monitoring Division runs 6 different air monitoring stations, permanent stations throughout the district. All six of them measure PM 2.5, 5 of them measure ozone, and 2 of them measure for PM 10. We have an additional three monitors that we put out seasonally up in the San Lorenzo Valley to support the Spare the Air program during the winter months when we see higher concentrations of PM2.5 from wood-burning stoves and fireplaces. There's also an additional monitoring station that is operated by the National Park Service. We have no responsibility over that station. That's established there for purposes of measuring visibility for the Class 1 airshed. So that's an air monitoring station that is used to determine attainment with the standards, but it's not one that we operate. This is an example of a couple of the air monitoring stations. There's a station in Carmel Valley and a station in Salinas. Each of the stations consists of a structure that houses the air monitoring equipment with sample ports extended to the outside ambient air, as well as weather stations at each of the sites. These are the California National standards for ozone PM2.5 and PM10. These are the goals that we're trying to meet as an air district. This is the goalpost that we're trying to kick the ball over. So we're all of our programs are focused on trying to meet these standards. That's the one single goal that we're trying to achieve. So this is the hourly peak ozone that we've measured so far through July for each of the counties. As you can see, the dotted line at 90 parts per billion is the state standard, the more stringent standard that we're trying to meet. And all of our stations are meeting those, are within the standard this year. There is a spike that you'll see in June, a few spikes in June. The beginning of June, we saw higher temperatures. Ozone is a secondary pollutant that is derived from a reaction with nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds in the presence of sunlight. So when we see hotter days, we'll start to see higher concentrations of ozone. And that's what we're seeing in June. At the end of June, there was also a fire east of King City, 2,500 acres, so we might have been seeing some higher concentrations of ozone due to that. Not as likely, but that's a possibility. But the main point here is that we haven't exceeded the standard at all. For the 8-hour standard, this is an 8-hour average, 8-hour running average. We're seeing similar numbers, although we're still below the state standard of 70 parts per billion. For PM2.5, this is the ultra-fine particles that you might see in smoke. We're well into attainment for the federal standards. There is not a state 24-hour standard for PM2.5. We're well below the standard for most of the year, except for one day on June 15th. There was a 25-acre grass fire, which occurred near the soccer complex off of Constitution Boulevard in Salinas. And so that's why our Salinas station is showing an exceeding of the standard on that day. PM10, this is a little bit unusual. We have two PM10 monitoring sites, one in King City and the other in Hollister. Usually by May, we start to see exceedances of the state standard for PM10. PM10 is a larger component of fine particles that usually represent dust. And so if you've got open agricultural fields in Salinas or in Salinas Valley, and when we have a 20-mile-per-hour-plus wind ripping down the valley, we'll start to see the concentrations exceed the state standard for PM10. So our attainment status for federal designation is we're all in attainment. That's good news. For the state designations, we're non-attainment transitional for ozone. Transitional means that we've had less than four exceedances for the prior year. So we're now in transitional. We had no exceedances in 2017, I'm sorry, we had several exceedances in 2017. That wasn't more than four. We had several excused due to some wildfires. That was 2016. 2017, we didn't have any exceedances. 2018, we had one exceedance. So we're still non-attainment transitional. For PM10, that last chart I showed you, we usually exceed up to 30-35 days per year for PM10, so we're still non-attainment for the state standard for PM10. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Any questions from the board members?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. When you have these burns, prescribed burns, does that affect these numbers at all?
It can.
We have to have these prescribed burns. Mm-hmm. There's no getting around it. But do you adjust for that, and does that affect our compliance with the state standards?
Yes. Do you want to answer that? Okay.
Good. I would hope that, at times, San Diego County has been noted for poor air quality, and there's a lot of reasons that air flows downhill, kind of like water. Santa Clara, maybe a prescribed burn in Monterey, kind of ends up in the pocket of John Pinnacles, and it should be a footnote as far as even those things do, happen. Thank you.
Any other questions? Great. Thank you so much. Moving on to 14, we're going to receive and accept and file a report on the mid-year 2019 engineering and compliance activity.
So this is the companion report to the planning and air monitoring report, where we used to give it to you monthly, and now we're doing a twice-a-year check-in. So just going to go through kind of just a briefing on, again, what engineering compliance do, sort of what our routine activities are, and then the data that supports that activity. So in engineering, primarily the routine activities are evaluating and issuing permits, creating new rules and regulations. Sometimes the state gives us new regulations that then mean we need a local rule to address that, so we'll work on that. Every year we report emissions inventory for our larger stationary sources to the state. I can see it changed on the computer over there. So the next screen that will show up is the table of the activity data. And so we're kind of tracking similar to what we normally do. We do have received more permit applications this year. And we think part of that in June was an uptick because there's portable engines that have a certain emission rating, and they're not allowed to operate in starting in January 2020 unless they take a low use limit or an emergency use provision on their permit. And so we saw an uptick in permits, we think, partially because of that. But you can see that engineers are getting out. They've done 55 inspections, which they do before they'll issue a permit. We've issued 164 permits. We don't have any backlog. We have 6 months to issue permits once we've deemed an application complete, and we're meeting that deadline. Everyone's getting their permits usually much faster than 6 months. We've issued 73 authorities to construct, and those are what are issued before a permit is issued. So you apply for a new piece of equipment, and you tell us what it is, and then we'll go out and do that inspection, and if it meets our specifications, it's we've evaluated it for all of our rules and regulations, then they'll issue the permit. So we've done 73 of those. We've only seen 4 ag engine registrations. We don't get quite as many of those as regular permits. Our Title V permits are renewed every 5 years, and there are 16 of those types of sources now, so those are kind of an ongoing every 5 years, or there's some sort of modification that needs to be made, then we'll have to issue those again. And then emission reduction credits, that's if a company shuts down some equipment, they'll turn in an application and say, we want to put some emissions in your bank, which maybe they'll use later for another project at their facility, or they can have the option to sell those credits to another company that may want to use them. So just wanted to give you some examples of the numbers and kinds of equipment. So our number one type of permit is emergency engines. We have about 1,100 of those out of our total of 3,000 permits, so that's our biggest category. We have 392 gasoline dispensing facilities, 314 paint spray facilities, 207 boilers, and 152 prime engines. So those represent the bulk of what we have permitted in the district. So once those permits are issued, then it kind of gets handed off to compliance. And that's when our inspectors go out every year and they check and make sure that everyone has a permit, meeting the conditions on their permit. So they're conducting those inspections. They're making sure that, you know, if there's some violations, that they'll issue a violation so we can correct that and get the source back into compliance. We also have a team that works on the federal asbestos regulation, and that has to do with demolishing or renovating structures. You need to remove the asbestos. And then another fun job is responding to complaints. So our inspectors get to do all of those. Those are our kind of routine activities in compliance. So our goal is to try to get to inspect all of our sources every year. Right now, we're probably hitting about half of our sources every year. So some of those sources, like the emergency engines, we'll get those every other year. They're limited on their hours. They can operate every year for testing and maintenance. So it's not necessarily a source we feel like you need to go to all, you know, regularly. The sources, like a gas station, we go to all of our gas stations every year. There's a lot more requirements on them, and since you have the public handling the equipment, a lot of times you get out there and find out the equipment, there's tears in the hoses or nozzles aren't working right, so we go to our gas stations every year. So when the inspectors are out in the field, they'll issue something called a notice to comply. And that's something, if it's more of an administrative or paperwork, kind of you're not maintaining your log or something like that, then you'll get a notice to comply. And that is usually able to be corrected and it doesn't go farther. But if it's a more serious violation, then we'll move forward with a notice of violation, which will then come with penalties. So as I mentioned, our asbestos program, they go out and also do inspections. So we get notified when someone's going to do a renovation or demolition. We'll send an inspector out. We did 77 of those. And we received 177 notifications. We also received 113 complaints, and those I'll talk about in just a moment, the different categories. 15 breakdowns, that's if a piece of equipment. So some of the larger, like the gas turbines at the Mossland Power Plant, have equipment that's constantly measuring their emissions. If something on that isn't working properly, didn't get up to temperature, they'll call in a breakdown and say our equipment's not working, and we'll fix it right away. We also went out and observed seven source festivals. Many of our sources are required to have a company, a third-party company, come out and test their stack, what's coming out of the stack every year. And so our inspectors try to get out to those as well. So just so you know the variety of the kind of complaints that we're addressing. So far this year, number one on the list has been smoke, and that's primarily people complaining about smoke from their chimneys, their neighbors' chimneys, or a small fire, recreational kind of fire in someone's backyard. And then odors and dust are pretty close in second place there. And a lot of times we find smoke complaints quite often are in Santa Cruz County and places where people use fireplaces more often. Odor complaints are kind of universal in all three counties. And then dust complaints are more likely to happen in the Salinas Valley. And then we got seven complaints about asbestos, five on gas stations, and then four were just other different kinds of complaints. Okay, are there any questions?
I mentioned that if there are issues that are basically administrative, you know, keeping the logs up and so on, you issue a notice to comply, and then there can be actual violation. I don't see a category that spells that out.
So that's covered every month in the mutual settlement report, which is part of the consent agenda, so that's the violation.
Yes.
So those are, yeah, it's monthly. Yeah.
Any other questions? Any comments from the public? Seeing none, thank you for the presentation. Moving on to item number 15, which is to receive an annual report on the district air toxics program.
So I'll just introduce Song Kim, one of our engineers, is going to be doing the presentation. And he's going to be talking about our toxics program, which is a program that kind of falls outside. It's a little different than our regular routine activities, doing permits, issuing permits. We're doing facility-wide look at all of the emission sources within the boundary of one facility, not just, you know, when you issue permits for one piece of equipment at a time, this is saying what's the impact from all of the equipment at one facility. So I'll hand it over to Song.
Afternoon. My name is Song, so I'll go deep into the our air toxics program. Some of the main points that I'll be talking over in this presentation is basically what is an air toxic, what is the program, what are our current activities, and what is our implementation plan timeline. So what is an air toxic? An air toxic is basically a pollutant that may cause or can cause cancer or significant health problems. These pollutants are identified by two sources. First source would be from EPA. They define it as hazardous air pollutants, or HAPs. And the second source where we find these pollutants are from the state, which they identify as TACs, or known as toxic air contaminants. So what is the Air Toxic Hotspots Act? So back in 1987, the California legislature adopted the AB-2588 program, which stands for Air Toxic Hotspots Information Assessment Act. And what it does is requires facilities that are subject to the program to provide a plan to the district that is subject to approval. After the approval of the plan, they report those emissions. After reporting those emissions, we prioritize these scores based upon their emissions, and depending on their score, they may conduct what we call a health risk assessment. And after conducting the health risk assessment, if they trigger any of our significant risk thresholds, they will have to notify the public. So I mentioned, the next slide is going to talk about risk assessment. I mentioned something about prioritization scores. So basically what it is, we categorize, it's a very conservative risk assessment tool. that we use from their toxic emissions, and then we score them based upon their toxic emissions and what kind of pollutants that they are emitting. And they are scored into three different categories. The first category is low, so if a facility scores one or less, they're considered a low-level facility, and what that means that they are exempt from the AB2588 program. If they score in between 1 and 10, they're considered an intermediate risk level facility, which then means that they have to do a quadri annual report. So they would have to report their emissions every 4 years. And then if a facility scored 10 or more, they're considered a high risk level facility, which then means they're subject to do a detailed health risk assessment of their facility. So after conducting their detailed health risk assessment, the next slide will show you what triggers a public notification. So these, as you see on the table, these are the district significant risk thresholds. Be mindful that the other air districts from within the state of California have different thresholds. These are our standards. And so if a facility has a cancer risk score than 10 in a million, they would need to do a public notification. Or if any of those chronic risk index or acute risk index is greater than 1, then they also have to do a public notification. What does that mean afterwards? If they do trigger these significant risk thresholds, they have to do a public notification and do what we call a risk reduction audit and devise a plan. And so if they trigger those thresholds, they need to come up with a plan to find ways to reduce those risks below our risk threshold. And implement, and that is also subject to approval from the district. So changing gears, what are our current activities? Why are we doing this AB2588 program? So there have been changes to the guidance in evaluating risk. Back in 2015, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, also known as OEHA, they found new studies on childhood sensitivity. Because of those new studies, they had to update their calculation risk methodology, which therefore, you know, rekindled all their programs. So we had to reevaluate all our permitted facilities based upon the updated guidance. And then so what that means is starting in January 2018, we started getting notification to the facilities that are subject to this program. So we first started with our facilities that emit 10 tons per year or more of oxides of nitrogen, oxides of sulfur, VOCs, or particular matter. So this is, we're starting from 2018 to present. This is kind of what I've been working on. We have sent out about 26 facilities. I've yet to evaluate 8 of those, but these are our summary of what our different facilities here. You'll see some have scored low, some have scored intermediate, and we have currently 2 facilities that have triggered high priority, which basically means that they need to conduct a health risk assessment, and we are waiting for them to get those health risk assessment document from them and review them. And after we receive the health risk assessment, we have to send it to OEHA for the final approval. So what are our future activities? So of those 26 facilities that we notified back in 2018, I still have 8 facilities to review the plan and conduct a prioritization score to determine their risk level facilities. Like I said, of those 2 high-risk facilities, they need to receive the HRA document and send it to OEHA for review. And then starting in beginning of this month of August, we started our second phase of notification to less than 10 tons per year sources. And these sources are categorized, as you see there on the list, hospital, asphalt batch plants, chemical processing plants, and so forth. So this is a bit of our timeline. In May 2019, from 2018 to May 2019, I completed about 70% of our prioritization facilities for the greater than 10 tons per year. We start our first phase of notifications for facilities that are less than 10 tons per year in August. And then we hope to, as we are evaluating, we still hope to have our second phase of notification for our other less than 10 tons per year sources in July of 2020. And the whole goal of this plan timeline is hope to complete all our AB2588 program by 2021. And that basically completes my air toxic hotspots program. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Any public comment?
Yes, the hotspot in Santa Cruz, that's in a pretty urbanized area, is it not?
Yes, so the high-risk level facility, that facility is the city of Santa Cruz wastewater treatment plant. The reason why, again, they're high is because they're have old diesel engines and what they call dual-fuel engines that both use natural gas and digester gas. And part of why their risks are so high is because they're emitting as well a lot of toxic emissions, but at the same time, they're very close to a neighboring residential area. And so that also, because they're near sensitive receptors, that can drive the risk. And so that's why it was considered to be a high-risk level facility.
And has this issue been known for some time?
Well, because of the updated guidance from OEHA, we had to reevaluate it because the thing about the changes to the guidelines, the emissions may have not changed, but because to a fact of child sensitivity, they added this new conservative factor. And so they said that from this change, your risk is likely to be increased by 3 times. And so that is why we wanted to reevaluate all the permitted sources that, may have been, not a high risk, but because of the updated guidance, we found that this facility is considered high risk, and that's why they have to do a detailed health risk assessment to find that cancer risk number and to see if they're below our risk threshold. I did receive that report, and it's currently being reviewed by OEHA, and they are to be found less than 10 in a million, and so they did not trigger any of the significant risk thresholds, but that final approval needs to come from OEHA.
Thank you very much. Good luck in the review process.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Any public comment? All right, seeing none, that we will adjourn our meeting to our next meeting on September 18th, 2019. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for the good work.